This is John Beebe, The Future of Depth Psychology, January 8th, 1999, tape 2 of 2.
Nation, and so I noticed that I was so fascinated by each new dream that was being presented to me that I absolutely was forgetting to breathe. I was listening with truly bated breath for the next moment in the process. So one thing she wasn't getting was some air. So as so many people who've worked with the body started, I started with breathing. And I started with noticing my breathing. And so I made my handling of the... Everybody says in analysis the key is how the analyst handles his countertransference. And I had, you could call it a stable countertransference attitude of fascination and devotion. And that had its value for some of my patients, clearly, but it also was an imbalance because it was... So I had to get hold of the fact that I'm here too. And I started with just my breathing. So I consciously taught myself to breathe while I listened to patients. It changed the way I listened, that rather than passively listen, I would actually actively listen, but not in the sense that I mean that, in the sense that I had to be physically present in my listening, which meant that I might have to change my position, I might have to sigh, I might have to belch, I might have to yawn, I might have to interrupt. I had to make room for myself, and the patient was just going to have to live with the fact that I was there too. In other words, rather than being the perfect son to the depressed mother, which so many therapists are, I had to have an anima. I had to have my own inner body. So from that day forward that I discovered that, I've been giving her everything else she needs. That, you know, so that I make it a rule that I have to feel alive. And if I don't feel alive, I analyze with the person what is keeping me from feeling alive. And that, to me, is the analytic process. And I find that any time we are on target with what we should be talking about, however painful, I'm alive. And that I become absolutely dead and numb when we're in some unreal place or are letting some complex get us. So that's how I've come to work. But it's really noticing what's happening to the anima moment by moment. Now, that's true for an extroverted, intuitive male with an introverted sensation anima. Now, every person would have a different problem. For someone else, it might be a thinking anima or a feeling anima or a feeling animus. And each you know, for each of us, it's a different struggle. But it's extremely easy to ignore that part of oneself. And it's exactly there that one colludes with whatever is going on to make the patient ignore whatever part of himself got them into the fix that brought them into analysis. So all I can say is my life depended on it. And I've been so alive ever since I learned to do that. So that's the answer. Jogging just by itself, or going on a weight loss program, I didn't believe, would have been one more thing by the man taking his energy in one more craze, but it wouldn't necessarily have been what she wanted to do. Yeah. No, much more. I had to do so much work on the introverted sensation function before some actual real-life introverted sensation people would trust me enough to get close to me, and they have subsequently taught me how introverted sensation can be comfortable and nice, and what it looks like when it's a conscious function. It's beautiful. And they're grateful that I understand it, because not that many of my kind do. Well, that's, I think, a little piece of a journey that has served me well in terms of, it's a centerpiece to many of the other parts that I was talking about. Shall we let that be an evening? Good.
Welcome.
You can do this to give you more height.
It is the San Francisco Jung Institute Library Journal. So it's easy to remember if you're interested in subscribing. Let me see if I can convey to you the problem that I want us to work on. There's a problem that I have in mind, so that's why we've all heard the term individuation, and most of you have at some time or another watched at least one of the Bill Moyers interviews with Joseph Campbell, and so nowadays it's not uncommon to know something about the hero's journey, which at the beginning of the century was very important for C.G. Jung. In fact, his magnum opus of his youth was the book that we should really say by its German title, Wandlungen und Symbole der Libido, Transformations and Symbols of Libido, which he wrote as he was intuiting the idea of the collective unconscious, and as he was becoming less and less interested in working within the very tight boundaries that Sigmund Freud had marked out for psychoanalysis with his particular theory. Jung was attracted, he says in Wandlungen und Symbole der Libido, to Freud by that passage in Interpretation of Dreams where in the middle of discussing a particular dream and of a patient and how it might be approached, suddenly Freud starts talking about Oedipus. And Jung says that when he read this, it was absolutely thrilling. It was exactly as if he were walking down a modern street and suddenly there, standing as if no time had passed at all, was a Corinthian capital. In other words, a column, Corinthian column with its capital. So, still standing. In other words, at that moment he had this extraordinary vision that it was possible that the ancient world was still with us, still in our midst. That excited Jung's imagination as a psychiatric resident. And so he started reading everything Freud wrote and eventually treated one of his patients in the Freudian way and wrote to Freud about the treatment. That, of course, was the famous Sabina Spielrein. And so began a period of their work together. So one could say that right from the beginning, Jung's intuition was captured by Freud's archetypal vision, Freud's connecting matters in the psyche to matters archetypal through the mythologem of Oedipus. And there's no question that to a certain degree Freud did have an archetypal vision. People have visited his Freud Museum in London, have seen his collection of antiquities, and he was always on his desk table in his office, so forth, were Egyptian statues and so forth. And he really was quite interested in Oedipus and quite a lot of mythology. And the great poet Hilda Doolittle had an analysis with Freud relatively late in Freud's life. And seems from her description that it was quite an archetypal experience for her. So there's no question that what Jung thought he could find in Freud was there. But somehow in Freud's psychological unfolding, creating a theoretical structure that was tight and logical and consistent and could pass as a science was so incredibly important to him. It actually became a cause for him that thinking, and particularly extroverted thinking, came to rule rather than this intuitive gleam that had initially attracted C.G. Jung. Nowadays, we can understand this kind of thing typologically, and here I draw on that wonderful book on typology, which I recommend to all of you if you don't know it, The Lectures on Jung's Typology by Marie-Louise von Franz and James Hillman. This is the single book that I recommend for all of you to read. This is the book that I have read again and again and again. I cannot count the number of times. And I always get something more out of it. I think it's a crime psychologically that when Jungians think of type, they immediately think of MBTI and they think of the license plate. I'm an ENFP, I'm an ESTJ. And when I hear a Jungian say, I'm going to take the type test to find out what type I am, I want to cry, because it's one thing for a lay person or someone looking for a job to take the test and try to get oriented. But if one already has Jungian psychology, one should be trying to make these decisions on the basis of a feel for the inner world and its unfolding, rather than on the basis of a test constructed by someone else. Even though the test can be helpful and a clue, and I lecture regularly to the Bay Area Association for Psychological Type. I've been a keynote speaker for the Association for Psychological Type. I have many friends in the psychological type movement. But when you have already a psychological connection, you should be finding the types from within. You should be discovering them from within. And the problem is no one is teaching us how to do this except very, very few of us. In other words, the Jungian analytic movement hasn't done much with psychological type, with the very strong exception of a handful of people, of whom I'm one. And preeminently in her lifetime, Marie-Louise von Franz produced this book, which if one reads it, and Hillman's companion essay, equally useful in showing you how to think typologically, shows you how you can go about, how you can connect this up with your own material, your own dreams, your own work, which is exactly what Jung initially intended. So I'm going to draw on what she has rather heavily and show you some of my extensions today. But specifically, I want to draw upon her assessment, you might say, of Sigmund Freud. She feels that his leading consciousness, using the language of psychological type, was introverted feeling. And this has often surprised people who think so much of Freud the thinker, or perhaps Freud the worldly. I've seen many people describe Freud as extroverted sensation type. Other people think of him as thinking. But both she and Jung, also in one of his letters, says the same thing. We're convinced that Freud's leading function was introverted feeling, and I have to say that everything I've learned about Freud convinces me that that is the case. I should say that Hillman's statement in the companion essay on the feeling function in that book is a very useful statement. He says the types are not easily recognized. I find that to be exactly right. That's one of my two favorite statements in psychology. The other is Jung's way of approaching any dream by saying always, "I do not understand this dream." So if I start with "I do not understand this dream" and the types are not easily recognized, usually I come out just fine. But if I imagine that I can get the type right and I imagine I understand the dream, then psychology has left. There is no psychology. So you could say doubt and uncertainty is the beginning of psychology. So your mother, who instilled those in you, didn't completely ruin you. She may have set you on the psychological path. So why introverted feeling for Freud? Well, for one thing, he had a quality of hidden gentlemanliness, which is probably the hallmark. He had great dignity and reserve. As von Franz says, he was really an excellent analyst. There was really a difference in many ways between the man and his theory. He had more than a touch of paranoia, which is not uncommon with introverted feeling. There is a tendency for introverted feeling to get pretty suspicious under certain circumstances. He wrote beautifully, which is often something introverted feeling people can do. It was much harder for him, it seems, to express feeling directly, and in fact, he couldn't stand to look the patient in the eye. So he not only put the patient on the couch, but he sat behind the patient. Now, an awful lot of people who do couch work do it in an extremely interactive way, so though the person's on the couch, there's still an awful lot of interaction, but not with Freud. He had to be out of sight. He was very, very concerned about power and power issues. Tracked the distribution of authority very, very carefully, and sometimes played his disciples against each other so that they wouldn't, so that he, in such a way as to maintain his power. But above all, we can recognize, I think, the truth of this type diagnosis, if you like, of a man we've never met. Not so much by looking at some of the attributes of his superior function, but by looking to see what was his cause in life. And there seems to be no question that Freud's cause was the psychoanalytic theory. And when you look at a person's cause, you're really looking at the investment of the anima or animus of that particular personality. And the anima and the animus that Jung has written about is, for me, the greater part of any person's character. The superior function that may be their ego orientation or their conscious position may be what the person imagines they are or what we know them to be good at and what we call upon them to use if we have them as a member of an organization. But when we start getting into the nature of the character of the person, often it's more interesting to look at where their passion is, you see, where their energy is. And usually in any interesting person, that's likely to come from the anima or the animus. So the man Freud may well have been an introverted, feeling Viennese man, Viennese Jewish man of a certain cultural, educational status, perhaps not in some ways that different from many other cultured Central Europeans of his time, with introverted feeling and of a certain type of person you can still meet today. The thing the world remembers is what happened after his anima came up at midlife and charged him with the responsibility of an extroverted thinking project. Because the essence of von Franz's discussion in the book I've recommended to you on the inferior function is that each of the eight consciousnesses that Jung maps out for us and calls in the original book, 1921, he calls those eight consciousnesses the psychological types. They are the types, and everything else is made up of those. They are the basic units or building blocks. So we get our terminology right at the outset, because MBTI uses the term type for the 16 profiles that come by matching the superior function with the auxiliary function, to use type language for a minute. So they would say, if they would agree with Jung and von Franz's assessment, that Freud, with introverted feeling superior and extroverted sensation auxiliary, they would type him as an ISFP, if they agreed that those were the first two leading functions. And they would say ISFP is his type. But actually, what they're calling a type, I would call a type profile. They have already begun to describe the personality in terms of two of its consciousnesses. Now, in fact, I think each and every personality that we will ever encounter in life is made up of eight consciousnesses, each with varying strengths, varying complexes, carrying those consciousnesses. And right now I'm trying to get you to focus on what one of those consciousnesses is doing in Sigmund Freud. And that one consciousness I'm asking you to look at is what Jung calls his inferior function, Freud would call Freud's inferior function of extroverted thinking. And I'm saying that that is the typological consciousness that's associated with Freud's anima. So we have in Freud a creative, anima-driven, extroverted thinking, which is his cause, which is creating the psychoanalytic theory, and extremely insistent on that theory staying just the way she delivered it. You could say in slang, Freud was quite bitchy about his theory. We can also say about Freud's theory that it has one of the hallmarks of the anima. It was extraordinarily seductive. It seduced more than one generation of intellectual people, and that is not so easy to do. And now, it's interesting how the whole theory began with the abandonment of the seduction theory. It's as if, and then what came was a seductive theory, which, and so in the last 20 years, we've seen a return to the seduction theory, the discovery that people actually are abused, and it isn't just a fantasy based on a projection of the infantile psyche. And the intellectual trend is very much against Freud right now. It's everywhere. People are bringing out books showing how they have been seduced, how the facts have been assembled to create a misleading impression. And that psychoanalysis isn't really a science at all, that the whole thing has been people speak of it almost as if it were a swindle in academic circles. Some of them, the very same people who 25 years ago or 30 years ago were pushing the theory as a valid academic methodology. So it's an interesting intellectual history. But Jung was the first, and he's still the best critic of Freud. And he both understood the limitation and the value. And I don't think anyone else has been able to bring off that. And I think increasingly we'll see that Jung's take on Freud was extremely on and apt. And Jung caught on rather quickly that there was something dogmatic and coercive and anima-driven about the way Freud had to have his followers fall in line with his anima. In fact, around the time he began to suspect that Jung was going too much his own way, he did something which has only subsequently come out. He got a group of his followers together, and he gave them all rings, and each of them wore a ring which represented their marriage to the theory, and he made them promise never to abandon the basic tenets of psychoanalysis. So Phyllis Grosskirch has written about this in a book called The Secret Ring. So we have sort of a strange ritual, like something out of the Cathars in the late Middle Ages, that you have a set of medieval knights pledging fealty to the lady, and the lady is the theory, you see. And so there we have the degree of Freud's anima investment in his midlife project. Now, think about it. You've all probably edged, if not fallen over the cliff into midlife, and some of you are crawling back. Some of you have had fabulous experiences. Some have had very painful experiences, but all of you have had vivid experiences, and whatever you've got is pretty important to you, I would imagine. And so we all have a midlife project, and we all have a certain investment in it. So one can have a certain sympathy with Freud not wanting the young whippersnappers just to take it anywhere they wanted. So Jung did not find what he was looking for in Freud, because what he was looking for was sort of a creative exuberance in Freud's character that became less and less visible as time went on. And that creative exuberance was the introverted intuition on the side of Freud's personality that enabled him to a limited but absolutely brilliant degree to spot an archetype in the middle of the psyche. And the archetype that Freud spotted was Oedipus. And there was a lot of narcissistic investment on Freud's part in Oedipus. And we know that now from studies of Freud's biography. This went on from an extremely early age, that he was interested in this particular play of Sophocles and this particular hero who succeeded in solving the riddle of the Sphinx and then was given, as a consequence of passing that hero's test, rulership of the city. And we can only imagine why this might have been important to a gifted young man studying in Vienna who could feel that he had a wonderful first-class mind and was a hard worker, extremely ambitious, and limited mainly by the fact that he was Jewish, from being able to get the kind of academic rank and standing that Christian professional with his particular strengths would have just automatically had. So Oedipus, whose name meant swollen foot because his feet had been lamed as a baby when he was left on the mountainside to die so that he would not be able to get anywhere, and had overcome these obstacles to become the great hero who solved the riddle of the Sphinx and therefore was given rulership of Thebes, must have in some way spoken to Freud's own puer wish to be some kind of hero. So it became a kind of a mythological and it happens that if one has a superior introverted feeling, and if, as I think, Freud had a strong auxiliary extroverted sensation, that he would have, as his third consciousness, as his third function, an introverted intuition, which I have learned is associated in that position with the archetype of the puer aeternus. So the narcissistically injured but ambitious wounded but inflated gifted child within Freud was associated with an intuitive and an introverted intuitive function, and somehow in symbolizing his own dilemma, he chose an archetypal model which also had the potential for the realization of his own ambition, and so he became very interested for a long time in the mythology of Oedipus. And so it was no accident at all that he was able to locate Oedipal material relatively early unconscious. And James Hillman has actually written a paper that you can find in which he goes back to Oedipus, and he says that psychoanalysis's whole method is Oedipal. It's all about this unraveling of the secret, solving the riddle, even the play. If you ever see the play of Oedipus Rex, it's at the core of the play. There's a secret which is gradually uncovered, and this whole fantasy that we will come to and heroically get to the truth is all in there. So that side of things was very, very alive for the young Freud, and it was that ability to see into the archetypal which so attracted the young C.G. Jung. Now, introverted intuition as a consciousness is precisely that consciousness which sees the archetypal. That's what introverted intuition does. Introverted intuition sees the archetypal. If you have an introverted intuitive analyst, for instance, your introverted intuitive analyst will usually be a quiet, attentive listener who won't say a great deal, but while you're talking, the analyst's mind will be working, and often it'll be working by forming an image. And the image will just come, and the image will often be an archetypal image, which gets behind what you've said. Occasionally, if you're lucky, the analyst will share the image. It doesn't happen very often with an introverted intuitive, but if they do share the image, it's almost as if someone has dreamed for you. They just sort of, the image just marvelously captures your situation in an entirely fresh and archetypal way. And the introverted intuitive consciousness, as I said in the lecture last night when I brought it up briefly, is very interested in the religious and religious problems, sees things in a kind of from a more timeless and often more religious perspective, religious, archetypal, timeless. Now, for the most part, that wasn't Sigmund Freud. For the most part, Sigmund Freud was very identified not patrician, and at times very patronizing, something that Jung could not abide, and that became the occasion for their final break when Freud could not restrain himself from pointing out one more slip of the pen. Jung had finally had it. So Jung may have expected show Jung what to do with his introverted intuition. Here was a man who knew what you did. You looked beyond the surface of things and found the religious archetype behind it. And that was the incredible promise of Oedipus. And perhaps Freud was then a practical Nietzsche, because Nietzsche in philosophy had already opened up the possibility of an archetypal imagination with his extraordinary essay that Freud and Jung and just about every other German-speaking intellectual read, and then finally English-speaking intellectuals too, that 1872 essay, the Birth of Tragedy in the Spirit of Music, in which Nietzsche talked about two consciousnesses, the Apollonian and the Dionysian, and in this thrilling way showed that culture could be analyzed in an archetypal way. So in Freud, Jung also thought he'd found in an actual doctor someone who could put this to practical use in the elucidation of specific clinical situations, which for a young psychiatrist was wonderful, because we all love our philosophy books, but how can we connect them up with what we actually do every day? And here was the way. So here was a chance to make introverted intuition practical. And here, you know, not as Nietzsche did, wonderfully impractical, but just theoretical, but really, really practical. And when he realized, Jung, after several years of involvement, that yes, there was the archetype of Oedipus, but as far as Freud was concerned, that was going to be the only one. That was Freud's only archetype. That was too little for this introverted, intuitive giant, Jung, who needed to feel free to use his imagination unfettered by a theory which forced everything into the same idea again and again and again. Unfortunately, the extroverted thinking in Freud latched on to the Oedipus archetype, and of course archetype and idea are the same thing, but then if you take the idea and then sort of use it the way extroverted thinking does, with, as like a general, and make it the idea, the only idea, and make a dogma of it and push that idea and make it, and put the entire theory around that one idea, then you put everyone else's intuition in chains because they're not free to move to other ideas, other archetypal ideas. That was finally intolerable for Jung. And I'm convinced that the real reason for the break was that Jung could not be contained within the puer, introverted intuition, and of Freud, and certainly not within that anima extroverted thinking straitjacket of Freud. In other words, Jung needed to use his own introverted intuition in a free and flexible, heroic way, going from archetype to archetype, and he needed to use his own auxiliary extroverted thinking freely to create a freewheeling theory that was just as flexible in its way and fatherly as Freud's extroverted sensation had been. In other words, the problem is that here we have Jung with superior introverted intuition and auxiliary extroverted thinking starting out trying to contain himself within Freud's third and fourth functions. You see, Freud's introverted intuition, puer, and Jung's and Freud's extroverted thinking, anima. Now, let me show you a diagram that just lays that out for you. I'm showing you this because the language of type is going to be with us all day today, and I think you should see the model that I have evolved to make sense of the types so that I can actually use them as a tool in the analysis of character. Those of you who've already studied psychological types are aware of the term function. Function comes from a Sanskrit word, bhunj, which, as Hillman says in his essay in that book, Lectures on Jung's Typology, means to enjoy. A function is something one enjoys using. Functions enjoy functioning. And so they represent... A function is a useful state of mind we enjoy getting into that enjoys performing its particular function. And these functions are, in Jungian jargon, functions of consciousness. And that's what the psychological types are. I always say functions of what, types of what, and the answer is consciousness. What Jung gave us in his ability to see what the psyche is doing is that the psyche is busy building consciousness. And human beings become conscious by differentiating various psychological functions. And Jung felt that in all, eight could be named. And I'll name them: introverted feeling, extroverted feeling, introverted thinking, extroverted thinking, introverted sensation, introverted intuition. I say it that way rather than say it the way you often hear it, that on the one hand there's extroversion and introversion, which are two basic attitudes, and on the other hand there are four functions, which are thinking, feeling, sensation, and intuition. That's the way we're always taught it, and as soon as we teach it that way, we've already lost it, because that's not how it happens to us. They don't happen to us as four functions. They happen as eight functions. I mean, I'm at a given moment in time, I'm usually in one of my functions. So I'm not in just feeling, if I'm in feeling at all. I'm in extroverted feeling, or I'm in introverted feeling. And if I'm in thinking, I'm not in just thinking generally. I'm in introverted thinking or extroverted thinking. And they're so different that they really shouldn't even be called the same thing. These are really eight countries, and they're often symbolized in our dreams as countries. You go to Russia, you go to Italy, you go to France. As you go to these countries in your dreams, you're going into the new territory of another psychological function. They're also symbolized in our dreams by people. And people are characterized, above all, by their individuality, by their difference. The one thing is to know two fingerprints are the same and no two personalities are exactly the same. And nothing is more characteristic of a person than their consciousness, such as it is. And so our psychological life is built up of a series of consciousnesses in various states of order or disorder, some very well differentiated, some that are really a mess, and each carried by different complexes. So what this does is show you a possible structure for those complexes that I've built up over time, which, if you look closely, builds on the model of psychological types as described by Jung and his followers. And that's where the number 1, 2, 3, and 4 and the parts in parentheses in this diagram come up. That in the language of type, Jung speaks of a superior function and an auxiliary function, and an inferior function, and then a tertiary function. The first three are capable of a degree of differentiation by ordinary ego consciousness. That is to say, they take training. The fourth function, is highly autonomous and very connected to the unconscious and cannot simply be trained. One can play at it, but it tends to emerge, and it also tends to disappear. The word inferior is often a misleading term to many because they get it confused with what we're worst at. And it isn't necessarily always the case, as saying that Freud created his entire psychoanalytic theory out of his inferior function. Whatever else you can say is it's a very brilliant extroverted thinking model of the psyche. And so inferior function for that, that seems people often balk at that. And certainly he was good at extroverted thinking when he did it, far better than I am, and it's not my inferior function. Although it is a shadow function for me, but still it isn't my inferior function. The way I relate to the notion of inferior function is that around the inferior function, there really is an experience of inferiority. I carry at all times a colossal sense of inferiority around my introverted sensation. I'm a superior extroverted intuitive. And if you have extroverted intuitive up where the hero is, you will find, if you look deeply into type, that you'll have introverted sensation down where the anima is. And I was talking last night about my figure in my dream, the Chinese woman who didn't have anything, as an image of my introverted sensation. I knew that that was her type because she was my Chinese laundress and took my laundry to her, and she worked in a very sensation-oriented way, and she was good with the sensation function. So I had a personal association to make that. I have always carried a tremendous anxiety around my ability to manage detail. Now, isn't it interesting that the Library Journal, which I've edited for 20 years, comes in every year right on target with its budget, is in the black. It has the reputation of being the best edited Jungian journal with the fewest typographical errors, and I am the proofreader. Because my anxiety will not leave it alone until it's right. So out of one's inferior function sometimes, often, who will the parliamentarian turn out really to be in a group of people? The person who always checks the bylaws to see if what the group is about to do is legal? Will it be an extroverted thinking type? No, it'll be an introverted feeling type, working out of his inferior function and very carefully and painfully getting the thinking right for the organization. I mean, that happens all the time. So the inferior function sometimes build the most beautiful home and get it just right. It'll sometimes be an introverted intuitive who's working out of inferior extroverted sensation, wants to get every detail right. I mean, it becomes a project, particularly in the second half of life. So you have to sort of get a little loose in your understanding of type and realize, again, the enormous strength of the anima and the animus in our lives. But when we're looking at Freud and Jung now, this diagram can be used to make sense of two very different types of men. Now, can people see this over here? Everyone in the room? Now, if they could have just let each other be each other, all would have been fine. But unfortunately, Jung tried to make an identification with Freud. And Freud fostered the identification. He, in fact, made him the crown prince. Which meant that Jung was going to have to take his first two functions and identify them with someone else's third and fourth functions. So you're taking a man with a potentially heroic introverted intuition, and if that, and that was, of course, the later Jung became that heroic introverted intuitive when he made the descent into the unconscious. But he doesn't do that till he leaves Freud, remember. But still. And we're asking him to live within a side of Freud's character. We're asking him to live within Freud's puer introverted intuitive. Now, that's where this model comes in as a help, and I'm not reinventing the wheel. If I did, I would spend the whole seminar telling you how I got this model, but I've done that at other times and other places, and I'm obviously building on that work. So what you're getting today is a diagram with an enormous long story behind it. But the diagram shows you the archetypes that I am convinced are associated with these various positions. And I'm saying to you, and I'm asserting it as a dogma rather than developing it as why I think so, that associated with the third function is the archetype of the puer eternus, which means eternal boy. And we also have puella eterna, eternal girl. But I prefer what one of my patients said one day, the endless boy or the endless girl. But beyond that, I have found the puer eternus archetype or the puella eterna archetype has the quality of going through cycles of inflation and deflation. I mean, I suppose it comes out as to when she was good, she was very, very good, and when she was bad, she was horrid. But what I really experience it as is either the divine child or the wounded child. And I think there we can take a look at the Christ mythology. As a mythologem, where you have Christ giving the Sermon on the Mount, and not long after you have Christ on the cross, within that particular archetype, there is an amazing range of ups and downs. The Buddha was not connected up with the puer mythologem, so you don't get that. Buddha is a sort of a stable individuation story where there are discoveries and disappointments, but you get a building quality over a long period of time. You don't get this extraordinary biphasic quality that you get where you get the puer eternus. So we have Jesus dying young, and it's very interesting that it should be our Western culture's fate that its chief divinity would be connected with this particular mythologem. In other words, that God should have chosen to incarnate through the puer eternus in this case rather than through maybe the hero or another or the father or the mother or in some other place. It's an interesting question as to why that could have why that needed to happen in Western culture, but it did. Yes. Well, it may be that introverted intuition was the puer function of Western culture generally, that Western culture tends to be an extroverted thinking, introverted sensation culture. I mean, we know that's the typology of the American culture, and why has America turned out to be the leading power in the West? It must be because we accord with the typological demands of the Western psyche. There may be something intrinsically extroverted thinking, introverted sensations. So, as you say, the only way it could get to spirit would be through the puer. So that would probably be the answer to your question. So apparently the Western psyche itself has a typology. And so it's not surprising that we're the hero of the Western psyche, and it's not surprising that this introverted intuitive puer would come as the divinity. So the idea that the anima or animus carries the inferior function is very well established within Jungian circles. So, what I've done is simply map out the archetypes associated with all the other functions. And I've done it basically by looking at my own dreams and those of my patients and seeing what images are associated with which functions. And there have been a series of discoveries over a long period of about 15, 20 years of carefully typing images. And I've cross-checked it against movies to see what, using the method of psychological types, once I say what the type of the character in the movie is, then what's the archetype? And gradually this structure has revealed itself to me. So at this point I can write it up in this kind of high-tech way, and we can apply it to the dilemma of Jung and Freud as an introduction to the problem of character, and see that Jung's hero is trying to live through Freud as Freud's puer. Won't work. We're also seeing that Freud's own capacity to be a father, that is, a disseminator of psychological ideas, someone who comes forward and puts forth things, is trying to live in Freud's midlife anima project. In other words, Freud's anima is trying to contain Jung's budding fatherliness. So every time Jung writes a new essay in which he tries to make the psychoanalytic theory more usable, flexible, and helpful to the psychiatrists, Freud's anima cries foul. You're trying to kill me. You've got a death wish toward me. You do not want me to... I mean, we can go through the letters and through the history, and what we see are a series of anima, wounded anima responses to the... How could you betray me this way by saying this? And insisting that it has to be sexual, and it has to be sexuality, and You took my beautiful sexual theory and you called it just psychic energy and libido in general. That's terrible. And how could you do that? And so forth and so on. I mean, so it just didn't work. Identifications rarely do work. Unfortunately, that's the way most of us start. We make individuation sound sometimes as if it's just nature, it's the most natural thing in the world. But then, if you look closely, Jung also compares it to alchemy, which he says repeatedly is an opus contra naturam, a work against nature. And individuation is actually often very cruel work because it involves breaking identifications with family members, collectives, moving away from what your mother wanted, what your father wanted, what your sister wanted, and we all have that story who get involved in becoming ourselves. But especially individuation often doesn't even begin to happen until adaptation has exhausted its ability to be a chameleon. In other words, individuation begins when adaptation breaks down. I mean, Jung really was not a particularly interesting or admirable person when he came into Freud's life. He was a brilliant young person. But he looks to me like he was pure hell on wheels. I mean, he would have been hard for anybody to contain. And he certainly would not have been someone that one would make the crown prince or encourage. I mean, when someone like that comes my way and wants to identify with John Beebe, I try to run like hell and anything but accept an identification. In other words, very dangerous because I can already tell the person's going to need to break it. It isn't going to work. But he didn't know who he was. He just knew he wanted to be somebody. I mean, that's really the truth. He was one of those very bright people who was capable of reading a lot and knew he had an enormous gift and a whopping father complex, a whopping mother complex, a big anima problem. Minister's son who had to live out the shadow. I mean, he had all the stigmata of being difficult, a difficult man. So he gets a big crush on Freud, as he says, a religious crush. He just tries to make the identification with Freud. He is the most gifted and the most well-known young psychiatrist in Europe who already has an international reputation. And this is Freud's chance to get psychoanalysis into psychiatry. And it worked. Jung actually delivered on that promise. So Jung was the young general for the psychoanalytic movement. It's now been shown that when Jung became Freud's friend, Jung was more famous than Freud, even though he was quite a bit younger. So it's a very interesting story, and it's very interesting how Jung lost a great deal of his own prestige because he gave it all to Freud, and then when he broke with Freud, he couldn't get it back for himself. So he never again got psychiatry and the mental health establishment behind him. Whereas if he'd sort of saved it for himself, perhaps he might have. So it's an interesting, there's a tragedy there too. But there was something inauthentic about the ambitious young man trying to make an identification with the older man. And there was something extremely opportunistic about the older man letting him do that. And we see that in just about every academic department I can think of. And although the Freud-Jung tragedy is pretty traumatic, I've seen worse. I've seen suicides where the young man does the older man's work, and then the older man publishes books and gets prizes, and the young man doesn't get an academic appointment anywhere, and his career is nowhere. He's been used, and he commits suicide. I mean, I've seen terrible things happen when older men let younger men be their pooers for them. I mean, it's really quite a problem. So this is one of those things that can happen between men that one has to be watchful of. But the point is that at a certain point, Jung had to break the identification. And it was not working for him. Remember, at this point, Jung doesn't really know who he is. Things happen in the psyche long before we can diagram them on the board. You know, I mean, years later, when you sort it all out, it all makes sense. But when it's happening, it just is an emotional event. It comes up as emotion. It comes up unbidden. Someone says something, and you say something, and then someone does something, and then you do something, and the fat is in the fire. And usually, the part of the personality that acts the problem out and tries to solve the problem is the shadow. It's not a very nice part of our personality. So the problem may be as I diagrammed it, but the way the psyche solves the problem usually is to get very angry, often in a completely unrecognized way. In other words, when one is not allowed to be oneself, we now know that rage is the usual response to not being allowed to be oneself. So adolescents become enraged at their parents because their parents aren't allowing them to be themselves. And the reason is that the identification with the parents is no longer working for the developing identity. That's the dynamic. And the parents can't understand it because the children always identified with the parents and used those identifications to adapt to all through the latency period and became more and more successful. And then suddenly the golden age ends, and that same identification that seemed to be working so well and made such a well-behaved person is replaced by this rageful, narcissistic person that is undoing all the adaptation. It looks like all the work that's been done of socializing the child is for naught, and now we're back in behavior that's worse than the terrible twos was. I mean, what happened? The parents feel very betrayed. And the point is that the children were using the parents to get by, and the parents, that met needs of the parents. The parents fostered those identifications, but now with the developing identity, the identifications are starting to break down. And every time the parent bids back to reestablish the old healthy identification and get the person behaving adaptively and socially and civilly again, then something in the child becomes ever more vicious until often it reaches a point of absolute face-off where there can be no question of identification any longer, because there isn't even communication. There's a rupture sometimes of relationship. People are not speaking together. They may not even be living under the same roof. They go their separate ways. That happens not infrequently, and it's extremely painful and confusing and shame-inducing and guilt-provoking. It's terrible, but it's also a way of nature. And all of that, of course, is because the shadow has gotten into it, and the shadow fights dirty. And it's the dirty behavior of the shadow that people can't forgive. And it is perhaps to achieve a permanent estrangement that the shadow comes into play anyway. In other words, the shadow makes offers that the psyche can't refuse in another person. That is to say, the shadow so provokes a person that the person stops wanting that person in their life, which is what the shadow is intending to accomplish in the first place, to get the person to stop even wanting them to be identified. So that's how identifications are broken. And one sees it in marriage as well, a certain number, that incredible provocative behavior that occurs in marriages sometimes happens because one or the man is too much in the role of the wife's helpful animus, and finally he can't stand it, so he behaves in a way which is so unideal that she no longer wants him as her animus. Or infrequently we're seeing it now that the woman cannot stand being in the role of the helpful anima any longer, and so she becomes absolutely intolerable so that he will not make that expectation of her anymore. And these are things happening in people in their 40s, 50s. I mean, so these identifications with other people's archetypes are broken regularly by the shadow. So that gives us a chance to look at what shadow came out of C.G. Jung that enabled him to get Freud to stop trying to foster this identification. I say it that way because, unfortunately, Jung was not sufficiently self-aware to simply look at Freud in a dignified way and say, I can see that you want me to be that, but I can't be that. And I think the right thing for me to do is just to go elsewhere, and we'll do it as quietly and tastefully as possible. I mean, maybe if he'd been my patient. But if that wouldn't have been a difficult situation. No, this is how he did it. I told you that Freud found a slip of the pen in one of Jung's letters. The shadow figure they both used for the longest time to manage the tensions that were in fact taking place between them was Alfred Adler, because Alfred Adler had left the Freudian movement early on. So he was the paranoid. That was how he was the narcissistic. He was the renegade, the ungrateful, the rebel, the apostate, and the letters, they just trash Adler in their letters. So in that final fall of their correspondence, and we're talking about the fall of 1912, when, as always happens in these situations, they're fighting, and then they reconcile, and I've seen the folly of my ways, I understand completely, we're not going to have that problem again, and then the next argument, until the next argument comes, everything is turning into a misunderstanding. It's just this way, like as at the end of a marriage, you know? And so Jung is mightily asserting his loyalty to Freud, and he's saying it's a ridiculous thing that Adler and his cronies would ever think me one of theirs. But unfortunately, he doesn't write that. He says, it's ridiculous, he writes, that Adler and his cronies would ever think me one of ours. So Freud says in his reply, I hope you won't mind if I point out a slip of the pen that you had in your most recent letter. One thing to learn from this story is always check your work.